So this is Ron Coopersmith with ENT Today. I'm with Miles Pensack, the Executive Vice President of the Trilogic Society, among the many roles that he has, and we're going to talk. Welcome, Miles. How are you today?
Thanks, Ron. I am great, and just delighted to hear that you and the family were safe in Texas.
Oh, thank you. Before we get into talking about the Trilogic Society, I'd love to hear about kind of your background in otolaryngology, you know, about your practice, what your clinical passions are, how you got into the specialty.
Sure. Like so I am an example of sort of the pre-match and what I would call the spontaneous transformation of career. So I am where I am purely by a combination of serendipity, the benevolence and the generosity of some giants in our specialty, and you know, the classic be prepared and then the brass ring keeps coming around. So when I was I'm a native New Yorker. I did all my education in New York. I did my training in New Haven, Connecticut, my fellowship in Nashville, and I have been in Cincinnati now for 33 years. As a medical student, I thought I was going to go into pediatric cardiothoracic surgery. And I did my first 2 years of surgery with the idea that that was the future. I had one elective as a second year surgical resident, and everyone said, go ahead and do ENT because they don't let you take call on your own. And this is back in the days when we were on call in surgery every other night. This was going to be great. So I was at upstate New York in Syracuse, and my first week I saw Dan Rabuzzi do a neck dissection. And the second week I went to the OR and saw my very first microsurgery with Dr. Gasek. And I was totally smitten. I realized that while heart surgery was exciting and interesting, the elegance of ENT was far beyond that. So for anyone who knows Dr. Gasek, Dr. Gasek is not only a giant, but he's a fairly formal, intimidating guy. And so at the end of my rotation, I walked into Dick's office and I thanked him for a fabulous experience and asked him if I could start the residency the following July. And he said, well, you know, we go through the match and we've got residents coming in. And I'm not really sure whether the inner Brooklyn came out in me. And I looked at him and I said, well, Dr. Gasek, I understand that, but you've got me interested in ENT. You figure out how to get me trained. And I went off to my next rotation and got a call from him maybe 10 days later. And he said, all right, I've called around. There are three places that have an opening. Pittsburgh with a guy named Gene Myers. Mass Eye and Ear with my old partner, Hal Shupnick. And Yale with John Kirshner. And I really think you ought to go to Mass Eye and Ear because best place in the United States, and they do a lot of otology, etc. And I went home and I mentioned this to my wife, who said, well, they all sound interesting, but New Haven is a lot closer to my mother, and having a couple of babies, I really think you ought to go to New Haven. So I went, I interviewed there. Rick Pillsbury was in the operating room all day. I never got to meet him. Clarence Sasaki waved at me, was on his way to the OR. And Dr. Kirshner was busy, so he paged a chief resident and a senior resident, introduced me and said, why don't you take him down to the harbor for lunch? We went to the New Haven Harbor. Bob McRae and Rick Cuccio and I drank beer. I ate oysters. We had clams. I stayed there for 2.5 hours, got back to New Haven, and Dr. Kirshner was gone for the day. And the secretary said, well, you know, there's nobody here. We went back to Syracuse, and I said to my wife, well, I'm going to call Mass Eye and Ear, make an appointment, because this was clearly not what was going to happen. Long story very short, I was in the emergency room as the surgical resident on call, 11 o'clock at night. I got a phone call from Dr. Kirshner, who said to me, Miles, the boys really liked you and thought you'd be a great fit, so we'll see you July 1st. Long story short, I started, I did my residency at Yale, and as a first-year resident, Dr. Pillsbury had a labyrinthectomy at the VA. And I said, well, this is a perfect first-year resident case. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, you kill the ear, you kill the balance system. Sounds like a perfect case for me. And for anyone who knows Rick, he loves to set bars high, but he lives into his promises. And he said to me, if you go to the temporal bone lab and drill out and hand me a labyrinth and a cochlea tomorrow morning, you can do the case. So I stayed up all night, and I drilled, and I did whatever I needed to do. And the next morning, I presented him the bone. And Rick came to the VA, and as a first-year resident, he slogged through 6.5 hours of watching me do a labyrinthectomy. So I was seduced, and the next thing I knew, I had the opportunity to spend a fellowship year with Mike Glasscock, and wound up getting recruited, interestingly, to Cincinnati by the chair of neurosurgery, who wanted to start a skull-based program. We thought we'd be in the Midwest for 2 years, and as my wife said, we're 31 years over that mark, as we're starting on our 33rd year. And I've been surrounded by some extraordinary colleagues, both at Children's Hospital and the university. And what can I say? I have had some remarkable support and mentors along the way. But I'm one of those people whose career bounced through by opportunities coming about, and I've taken advantage of them.
I mean, it's an incredible story, and I love hearing, you know, these sort of stories about the people and the connections. And you know, since you've been at the University of Cincinnati, you know, not only have you been so involved in our specialty, but obviously, you know, you've done a ton at the university. Right. And you know, why don't you tell us about some of the positions you've held there and how you juggle all of this stuff?
So, for the first 25 years that pretty much that I was there, it was focused on building my skull-based practice, and I had some remarkably gifted and talented neurosurgical colleagues and supporters, and we were able to build a national referral base for some very, very complex skull-based work. We spent a lot of weekends in the lab, and to this day, I still remember the first time we did an anterior transpetrosal approach to a basort tip aneurysm. And back then, the mortality rate for that entity was close to 100%. And we operated on a Sunday afternoon on a 28-year-old, and on Tuesday morning, she walked out of the hospital. Wow. And so, you know, I've had that. I have had some remarkable colleagues in our specialty, Mike Glasscock and Daryl Brackman, the late Gail Neely. I've sort of gone through my career with Rob Jackler and Paul Lambert and Clough Shelton. And I just, you know, I feel remarkably fortunate because I come to meetings and I hear from these people. So a number of years ago, when Dr. Shumrick stepped down and Jack Luckman became the chair, Jack came to me and said, you know, you're pretty good at running the details end of business. I'm interested in where we are academically. Why don't you run the practice plan for our department? So I did that, and we were running an overhead of about 28%, which at universities is really low. I wound up running the operating room at University Hospital for 22 years. When Jack stepped down, I was fortunate to become the chair. And then somewhere along the line, we as a practice plan took all of our independent 501c3 corporations and formed one. And I looked and said, we're running the most efficient department in the medical center. I don't want to join. And the dean said, well, it's been nice knowing you. And so our department was dragged kicking and screaming in as the last department, and the ultimate reward for being the last in was I was made the CEO of the practice plan. And then I moved into the dean's office, and then I moved into running the physician division for our health system. And the juggling is relatively easy because I'm really surrounded by some remarkably gifted and talented people. And in order to satisfy a wide venue of administrative and clinical responsibilities, you have to have confidence and trust in the integrity and the work ethic of your partners and colleagues. And so the very first thing I did when I became the chair is I picked up the phone and called Chuck Meyer, who, if he's not the most prolific pediatric otolaryngologist in the universe, he certainly has got to be the busiest. And I said, Chuck, we've never had a vice chair, and so can we make a partnership? And so his strengths are my weaknesses, my strengths are his weaknesses, and we both share an absolute unabiding passion for baseball. And he's been my partner running our program now for 12, 13 years. And again, I'm the beneficiary of just being surrounded by people who are faster, taller, can hit three-point shots better, a little bit smarter. Some of them are a lot cuter, many of them much more handsome. But at the end of the day, I've always said that if, like real estate, it's better to own the least expensive house in an expensive neighborhood, and I've always sought out to be with people who force me to get my game up a bit.
It's really great. You know, it's interesting how a lot of the really successful groups and people, I know even in my group, you know, having someone that compliments you, you know, and being able to recognize that, you know, makes you really a strong team. Tell me about your history with Trilogic Society, and then about, you know, how you got to where you are with the Trilogic
so,
Society.
So again, you know, it's we in medicine, and actually maybe in society in general, pay enormous interest and respect to intellectual capacity. I actually happen to believe that smart people come a dime a dozen. So my coin of the realm is emotional intelligence, and I put much more value in that. So when I was a second year resident, the very first meeting I went to was in 1982, and John Kirshner was president of the Trilogic. There was virtually no travel budget at Yale for residents, so Rick Pillsbury took a room at the No-Tail Motel in West Palm Beach. John Cavitan and I took sleeping bags and slept on Rick's floor. We went over to the Breakers. I had never been to a place like that. And that the first afternoon, John Kirshner came, you know, through the lobby, and I'll never forget this. He said to John Cavitan and I, boys, you're not gonna believe what they've given me. And so he takes us out behind the Breakers, and there's this magnificent cabana. It's the president of the Trilogic's cabana. And he said, I don't have time for this. And he hands John, who is the chief resident, a key, and he said, you guys ought to enjoy this. So here's my first meeting. I've never been to the Breakers, and I have access to the president's cabana with a fully stocked bar. I went to meetings, I met luminaries, it was very heady stuff. So Thursday night used to be the black tie presidential banquet, and we saw Dr. Kirshner at the afternoon. He said, well, don't forget to be here at 6 o'clock for the dinner. I had one semi-used Brooks Brothers blue blazer. I did not own a black tie. I mean, Dr. Kirshner, you know, it doesn't matter, just show up at 6 o'clock. So that year, Frank Netter was his guest of honor. And they used to have a reception line as people would walk out of the Breakers into the area. And Dr. Kirshner positioned, it was Dr. Kirshner, it was me, and John Cavitan on the other side. It was Aileen Kirshner, Frank Netter, and Mrs. Netter. And every single luminary who came through, every department chair, all of the famous names from the 50s and 60s, Dr. Kirshner turned and introduced John and introduced me as, quote, his boys. And I left there, and despite the fact that my practice has been limited to otology and neurotology, there was no doubt in my mind there was something absolutely magical about the Trilogic. And so you sort of set goals for yourself, and in a far distant goal, it was to become president of the Trilogic Society and be able to do transformative stuff the way I thought Dr. Kirshner did for me. Down the road, there were a number of individuals, and the first person in the Trilogic who, for me, was a provocateur and an inseminator of change was Charlie Lecce. Charlie was the vice president, I think, of the middle section, and I went to all the middle section meetings, and Charlie transformed the age group. You know, the Trilogic up until the 90s was a society of older white guys. And I became the youngest secretary treasurer of a section in the Trilogic. And I did that for whatever years, and then I was vice president of the Trilogic in the midsection. And again, Rick Pillsbury, who has been a mentor and is one of my dearest and closest friends, the trial was losing money at the section meetings, and Rick and I said, you know, half the people who were in the middle section were going to the southern section meetings anyway. I mean, do you really want to be in the Midwest in the winter? They were going to the southern section. So in 2007, we put the middle and southern section meetings together. We came out with a profit of over $100,000 and broke every record for attendance. And we started pushing the idea that maybe sectionness had come and gone. And this was where Brian Neal, Jerry Healy, and Pat Brookhauser again recognized and said, and they gave me an opportunity. They gave me an opportunity to start now changing the organization. And we held a retreat. We raised a number of issues regarding how we were going to invest our corpus of money and structure. And then a few years ago, with Pat's untimely death, I found myself in the very unique opportunity of becoming Pat's replacement as executive vice president. And I think the reflection of my priorities and our society's buying into some change, we're getting much younger. The nature of our membership is dramatically changing. I mean, it's not a bunch of old white guys.
And it's growing.
It's growing, and you know, society memberships in this generation, you're right, you know, people tend not to be joining unless they see value add. And we have a significant growth of not only women and minorities in the Trilogic, but they are assuming leadership roles. Dana Thompson has single-handedly transformed the entire thesis concept, both in terms of the scope of the theses and what we are looking for, whether it's population health, history. There are a number of venues, and this year we have 37 new candidates. 25 new members came in last year. And again, I sort of look and I say that I have been the beneficiary of people who were gracious, engaged, and gave me opportunity. And you know, you're interviewing a whole bunch of people for these things, but I will tell you, I am, if not the most, I am one of the most fortunate people in our specialty.
I think that's great. I share the feeling, you know, personally myself. Tell me what the executive vice president of the Triologic Society does. What does that mean?
So I liken my administrative roles in the Triologic to the same that I have with a number of the hats I wear at the University of Cincinnati. There are a couple of very major definitions of leadership that, you know, and none is, you know, one is not better than the other, but the caveat, and I'll use a seasonally appropriate one, although the Bengals actually lost 7-6 yesterday with 4 interceptions and a fumble, but we won't even go there. I actually look at leadership as being the offensive tackle. And, you know, on a football team, the offensive tackle, from my point of view, is probably the second most important player. And they do two things. They block and allow running backs to get down the field, and they protect the quarterback. And so I look at my job as the EVP as blocking and tackling to enable our membership to get where they want to go. So that's number one. The second thing is I use the Disney World model of leadership, and that is when you go to Disney World, you don't see power and lights. You don't see sanitation and food delivery. You don't see air conditioning. You don't see all of that. It's all underground. And the whole thing above ground is the experience for the patron. My job working with our administration, and we have a phenomenal group, Gail, Marcia, doing extraordinary work, that should be invisible to our membership. And we have an incredibly dedicated executive committee. And adding on to that, our council, which rotates based on who's the secretary treasurer, et cetera, et cetera. I think when people join the leadership group, it becomes very clear. They're inseminated very early on with the concept of servant leadership. And servant leadership means being able to take calculated, disciplined, and thoughtful risk. But it also means to have, you know, a certain degree of fun. I mean, at the end of the day, we talk about the Triologic in terms of scholarship and academics, residence, research. We give out north of $600,000 a year between scientific grants and resident travel awards. But I, as based on my history, I still believe the key element is fellowship. So when people say, well, you know, nobody's coming to meetings anymore, I can transmit all the information I need intellectually, online. I'm enrolled at this weird program at Harvard MIT. I've been taking online courses there for 3 years now. But when it comes to meetings, I mean, I see you. You and I do not talk about your practice. I want to know how you are, how your family is, what's going on in Texas. You know, we are still engaged in a personal, and that's one of the beauties of medicine. It's about people. And I think the Triologic, as a relatively small group, although when I look at the statistics and I look at our senior membership and a maritime membership, it's growing, which means Triologic membership appears to confer longevity, but that's a whole separate statistic. It is about those interpersonal relationships, and we work very hard to foment and perpetuate that.
What do you think are the biggest opportunities for the society and the biggest threats to the society?
Okay. So the greatest opportunities are not being stagnant and not recognizing that if we're going to continue to mature and grow and evolve, we have to recognize that there are educational and societal changes and adapt. So as you and I, preface this conversation, we retired our historian's role, right? I mean, everything is in the cloud now. And we replaced it with a social media and cultural position. So we have new committees. We are just transitioned. Bob Miller, who did an extraordinary job getting ENT today off the ground. We had an interview process looking for a new editor. And very candidly, one of the candidates was someone who I didn't know, I'd never even heard of. Alex Chu came in and just blew the selection committee out of the water. NIH, NINCDS, the Department of Defense, VA are now all requiring that grants go to open access journals. Trilogic, through our publishing partners with Wiley, we were the first to market with LIO, Laryngoscope Interactive. So I think that advantaging and taking opportunity as it comes is the opportunity. And then the other part, of course, is recognizing that we as a nation, we as a society are changing, and we're embracing whole different demographic. So that's one. Now, the other part of that is that fundamental nature of physicians is not changing, right? I mean, by nature, people are exceedingly bright. They are type A personalities for the most part. They're competitive, they're driven. But a lot of that turns and translates to being aspirational. And while we've modified the requirements relative to the thesis, there is a celebration of excellence. We are all proud, whether it's our kids, our spouses, our significant others, our families, our friends. We take joy when they accomplish things. And one of the most momentous parts of the Trilogic is the morning new candidates come in, and every active member of the trio who's at the meeting is there. That's very powerful. It's joining a fellowship, and it's joining a club that's a little bit special. Anyone can join, but there are requirements. So that's the joy. The challenges are, unfortunately, they're very pedestrian. It costs more to put on meetings. Hotels and venues cost more. People don't have the flexibility of taking as much time away from practice. And again, it's ensuring that there's a hybridization of the intellectual and the social that makes it worth it for you or you and your family to get on a plane in January and come to a meeting. Just came from a COSM secretary meeting. COSM was built on a foundation of the Trilogic Society. But now when you add in head and neck and ASPO and AOS and ANS and the alphabet soup, ALA, ABEA, facial plastics, we're not a subspecialty. We are otolaryngology. And how do we maintain our universality in a universe of idiot savants like me who are practicing neuro-otology and otology? So that's a challenge, and again, you modify, you morph, you change, you challenge. There are always challenges out there, but as we pointed out, we started out in 1896, we are bigger, we are more robust, we are more attractive to a divergent population of our colleagues. I actually don't have a whole lot of concerns about our future. I think we're in great position.
And what kind of advice do you have to either, you know, people who are fellows already or people who are not fellows to get more involved in the Tri-Lodge? Yeah.
So the Trio, like most organizations, that's a, it's an issue, right? So we're a pyramidal structure, and there are only a finite number of, if you will, official positions. That being said, one of the most important things that I've articulated today is that I was nurtured, and I was mentored, and I was provoked, and I was encouraged, and in some cases, I was pushed by Trilogic members. And I am unaware of a single member of the Trilogic who is not willing to lend an ear or a hand to a medical student, a resident, a fellow, a potential candidate, or a new member in any venue, whether that is practice, whether that is academics, whether that's getting input regarding grant writing. There's a huge repository of intellectual and experiential knowledge, and that's how people get involved. It's one-on-one, and I always reflect on the variance and the experience. So our president now is Mark Persky. Mark is a true and true New Yorker, right? And as someone who grew up in New York, I recognize, I grew up and lived with the Mark Perskys of the world. Our incoming president next year practices in Rock Springs, Wyoming, Sigsby Duck. He's a community general otolaryngologist. And I can't even imagine any other organization that has that spectrum of individuals who rise to leadership, and each one of them brings a special view, vantage, perspective, and it's what makes the organization healthy. And I will never forget, you know, 2 years ago we lost our past president, Fred Owens, and Fred and I could not have come from different backgrounds. You know, Fred grew up in Hamlet in Kentucky, and I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and over a bunch of years, aside from the fact that we shared a passion for ear surgery, first time I ever went fly fishing was with Fred Owens. And I remember when he was giving his presidential address, and this was a remarkably accomplished individual. He was beloved by patients and colleagues, hugely successful practice, had a very prominent temporal bone course, set up the Dallas program for deaf education, and was truly a big man. He was physically big, and in stature and compassion, he was a large man, larger than life. And I will never forget Fred getting somewhat tearful and saying that becoming the president of the Trilogic was the diamond in the tiara. It was the high point of his career. And it says something about a society when someone who has achieved that much in the eyes of his colleagues, and more so the eyes of his patients and the eyes of his family, to make that statement.
Yeah, and Fred was certainly special. I met Fred when I was a resident in Texas. I won an award from the Texas Association of Otolaryngology in a contest that he ran, and then served on the board of the American Academy of Otolaryngology with him when he was treasurer. And he's the reason I'm a member of the, you know, a fellow of the Trilogic Society.
There you go.
He was so persistent in trying to get more private practitioners to do their thesis. And every time I saw him, he'd call me, he'd browbeat me. You know, he wanted to make sure that I did it, and I didn't want to let Fred down. And so just, you know, to add on to that. Well, this has been a great conversation. We've talked a lot of business. I want to ask you one last question.
Sure.
Before we close. You know, tell us something that a fun fact that we might not know about what you like to do in your free time.
So, I did not pick up a golf club until I was 62 years of age. Not for any reason other than the fact that I didn't have time. Alan Seiden, who's been my partner now for 33 years, has been encouraging me to play. As opposed to 99% of my friends whose spouses don't want them out on golf courses, my wife has been trying to encourage me to play for years. So I started to play. And the beauty starting at that age is that you got no ego infested. So I played by a different count. Instead of keeping a regular score, I played by ball count. I'd start out with three dozen balls, and somebody'd say, "What'd you shoot?" I shot a 26. That meant I lost 10 balls. And I'll never forget the day, my first day, I shot a 38, and which was great because I found enough balls to get up. So a year or so ago, I underwent spinal cord surgery that I think you know about, and I had this horrible slice. I was on the fairway on every drive. I mean, I was really good about that. The problem was most of the fairways were the ones that were over. They weren't on the fairway I was supposed to be on. So I have this spine surgery. They put bone grafts and plates in, and my slice is completely gone. I mean, had I known this, I would have had them operate on my spinal cord years ago. So I was playing with Dr. Seiden and Keith Wilson, one of our head and neck surgeons, a couple of weeks ago. And for the very first time, I hooked the ball, and I stood up, and I looked at both of them, and I said, "You got to get my surgeon on the phone." And they both got really nervous. And what happened? I said, "I think my grafts need to be moved over a little bit. I'm hooking the ball a bit." So I've become a late golfer. I am profoundly bad, and I describe myself as an EBU. Golfer who's an EBU is an ego building unit. So anytime you want to feel better about your game, invite me to be part of the foursome.
I might be a stronger EBU than you because I haven't played golf at all. So I can come and be your EBU. Miles, this was a great conversation. I appreciate your leadership. I mean, you've been an aspirational leader for me personally. This has been a lot of fun, and look forward to continuing to work together.
Great, Ron. Thank you so much.